Chapter 5. Why was it that the public school unnerved him? Scrutinizing it from above, he saw the duck-egg-shaped building, white against the dark, blurred surface of the planet, apparently dropped there in haste. It did not fit into its surroundings. As he parked in the paved lot at the entrance, he discovered that the tips of his fingers had whitened and lost feeling, a sign, familiar to him, that he was under tension. And yet this place did not bother David, who was picked up and flown here 3 days a week, along with other children of his achievement group. Evidently it was some factor in his own personal makeup. Perhaps because his knowledge of machines was so great, he could not accept the illusion of the school, could not play the game. For him, the artifacts of the school were neither inert nor alive. They were in some way both. Soon he sat in a waiting room, his toolbox beside him. From a magazine rack, he took a copy of Motor World and heard, with his trained ears, a switch click. The school had noted his presence. It noted which magazine he selected, how long he sat reading, what he took next. It measured him. A door opened, and a middle-aged woman wearing a tweed suit, smiling at him, said, "You must be Mr. Yee's repairman." "Yes," he said, standing. "So glad to see you." She beckoned him to follow her. "There's been so much fuss about this one teacher, but it is at the output stage." Striding down a corridor, she held a door open for him as he caught up. "The angry janitor," she said, pointing. He recognized it from his son's description. "It broke down suddenly," the woman was saying in his ear. "See? Right in the middle of its cycle. It had gone down the street and shouted, and then it was just about to wave its fist."
"Doesn't the master circuit know?"
"I am the master circuit," the middle-aged woman said, smiling at him cheerfully, her steel-rimmed glasses bright with the sparkle in her eyes.
"Of course," he said, chagrined.
"We think it might be this," the woman, or rather this peripatetic extension of the school, said, holding out a folded paper. Unwadding it, he found a diagrammed congeries of self-regulating feedback valves. "This is an authority figure, isn't it?" he said. "Teaches the child to respect property. Very righteous type, as the teachers go."
"Yes," the woman said.
Manually, he reset the angry janitor and restarted it. After clicking for a few moments, it turned red in the face, raised its arm, and shouted, "You boys keep out of here, you understand?" Watching the whiskery jowls tremble with indignation, the mouth open and shut, Jack Bolin could imagine the powerful effect it would have on a child. His own reaction was one of dislike. However, this construct was the essence of the successful teaching machine. It did a good job in conjunction with 24 other constructs placed, like booths in an amusement park, here and there along the corridors which made up the school. He could see the next teaching machine just around the corner. Several children stood respectfully in front of it as it delivered its harangue.
"And then I thought," it was telling them in an affable, informal voice, "my gosh, what is it we folks can learn from an experience like that? Do any of you know? You, Sally."
A small girl's voice.
Well, maybe we can learn that there is some good in everybody, no matter how bad they act."
"What do you say, Victor?" the teaching machine bumbled on. "Let's hear from Victor Plank."
A boy stammered.
I'd say about what Sally said, that most people are really good underneath if you take the trouble to really look. Is that right, Mr. Whitlock?"
So Jack was overhearing the Whitlock teaching machine. His son had spoken of it many times. It was a favorite of his. As he got out his tools, Jack listened to it. The Whitlock was an elderly, white-haired gentleman with a regional accent, perhaps that of Kansas. He was kindly, and he let others express themselves. He was a permissive variety of teaching machine, with none of the gruffness and authoritarian manner of the angry janitor. He was, in fact, as near as Jack could tell, a combination of Socrates and Dwight D. Eisenhower.
"Sheep are funny," the Whitlock said. "Now you look at how they behave when you throw some grub over the fence to them, such as corn stalks. Why, they'll spot that from a mile away."
The Whitlock chuckled.
"They're smart when it comes to what concerns them. And maybe that helps us see what true smartness is. It isn't having read a lot of books or knowing long words. It's being able to spot what's to our advantage. It's got to be useful to be real smartness."
Kneeling down, Jack began unscrewing the back from the angry janitor. The master circuit of the school stood watching.
This machine, he knew, went through its song and dance in response to a reel of instruction tape, but its performance was open to modification at each stage, depending on the behavior of its audience. It was not a closed system. It compared the children's answers with its own tape, then matched, classified, and at last responded. There was no room for a unique answer, because the teaching machine could recognize only a limited number of categories. And yet it gave a convincing illusion of being alive and viable. It was a triumph of engineering. Its advantage over a human teacher lay in its capacity to deal with each child individually. It tutored rather than merely teaching. A teaching machine could handle up to 1,000 pupils and yet never confuse one with the next. With each child, its responses altered so that it became a subtly different entity. Mechanical, yes, but almost infinitely complex. The teaching machines demonstrated a fact that Jack Bolin was well aware of. There was an astonishing depth to the so-called artificial. And yet he felt repelled by the teaching machines, for the entire public school was geared to a task which went contrary to his grain. The school was there not to inform or educate, but to mold, and along severely limited lines. It was the link to their inherited culture, and it peddled that culture in its entirety to the young. It bent its pupils to it. Perpetuation of the culture was the goal, and any special quirks in the children which might lead them in another direction had to be ironed out. It was a battle, Jack realized, between the composite psyche of the school and the individual psyches of the children, and the former held all the key cards. A child who did not properly respond was assumed to be autistic, that is, oriented according to a subjective factor that took precedence over his sense of objective reality. And that child wound up by being expelled from the school. He went, after that, to another sort of school entirely, one designed to rehabilitate him. He went to Camp Ben-Gurion. He could not be taught. He could only be dealt with as ill. Autism, Jack reflected as he unscrewed the back of the angry janitor, had become a self-serving concept for the authorities who governed Mars. It replaced the older term psychopath, which in its time had replaced moral imbecile, which had replaced criminally insane. And at Camp BG, the child had a human teacher, or rather, therapist. However, David had responded heartily to the teaching machines, had in fact scored very high. The boy liked most of his teachers and came home raving about them. He got along fine with even the most severe of them, and by now it was obvious that he had no problems. He was not autistic, and he would never see the inside of Camp BG. But this had not made Jack feel better. Nothing, Sylvia had pointed out, would make him feel better. Only the two possibilities lay open, the public school and Camp BG, and Jack distrusted both. And why was that? He did not know. Perhaps, he had once conjectured, it was because there really was such a condition as autism. It was a childhood form of schizophrenia, which a lot of people had. Schizophrenia was a major illness which touched sooner or later almost every family. It meant, simply, a person who could not live out the drives implanted in him by his society. The reality which the schizophrenic fell away from, or never incorporated in the first place, was the reality of interpersonal living, of life in a given culture with given values. It was not biological life or any form of inherited life, but life which was learned. It had to be picked up bit by bit from those around one, parents and teachers, authority figures in general, from everyone a person came in contact with during his formative years. The public school, then, was right to eject a child who did not learn, because what the child was learning was not merely facts or the basis of a money-making or even useful career. It went much deeper. The child learned that certain things in the culture around him were worth preserving at any cost. His values were fused with some objective human enterprise, and so he himself became a part of the tradition handed down to him. He maintained his heritage during his lifetime and even improved on it. He cared. True autism, Jack had decided, was in the last analysis an apathy toward public endeavor. It was a private existence carried on as if the individual person were the creator of all value, rather than merely the repository of inherited values. And Jack Bolin, for the life of him, could not accept the public school with its teaching machines as the sole arbiter of what was and what wasn't of value. For the values of a society were in ceaseless flux, and the public school was an attempt to stabilize those values, to gel them at a fixed point, to embalm them. The public school, he had long ago decided, was neurotic. It wanted a world in which nothing new came about, in which there were no surprises. And that was the world of the compulsive obsessive neurotic. It was not a healthy world at all. Once, a couple of years ago, he had told his wife his theory. Sylvia had listened with a reasonable amount of attention, and then she had said, "But you don't see the point, Jack. Try to understand. There are things so much worse than neurosis." Her voice had been low and firm, and he had listened. "We're just beginning to find them out. You know what they are. You've gone through them." And he had nodded because he did know what she meant. He himself had had a psychotic interlude in his early 20s. It was common. It was natural. And, he had to admit, it was horrible. It made the fixed, rigid, compulsive, neurotic public school seem a reference point by which one could gratefully steer one's course back to mankind and shared reality. It made him comprehend why a neurosis was a deliberate artifact, deliberately constructed by the ailing individual or by a society in crisis. It was an invention arising from necessity. "Don't knock neurosis," Sylvia had said to him, and he understood. Neurosis was a deliberate stopping, a freezing somewhere along the path of life, because beyond lay... Every schizophrenic knew what lay there, and every ex-schizophrenic, Jack thought, as he remembered his own episode. The two men across the room from him gazed at him queerly. What had he said? Herbert Hoover was a much better head of the FBI than Carrington will ever be. "I know I'm right," he added. "I'll lay you odds." His mind seemed fuzzy, and he sipped at his beer. Everything had become heavy, his arm and the glass itself. It was easier to look down rather than up. He studied the match folder on the coffee table. "You don't mean Herbert Hoover," Lou Notting said. "You mean J. Edgar." "Christ," Jack thought in dismay. Yes, he had said Herbert Hoover, and until they had pointed it out, it seemed okay. "What's the matter with me?" he wondered. "I feel like I'm half asleep." And yet he had gone to bed at 10 the night before, had slept almost 12 hours. "Excuse me," he said. "Of course I mean..." He felt his tongue stumble. With care, he said, "J. Edgar Hoover." But his voice sounded blurred and slowed down like a turntable losing its momentum. And now it was almost impossible for him to raise his head. He was falling asleep where he sat, there in Notting's living room, and yet his eyes weren't closing. He found when he tried that he couldn't close them. His attention had become riveted on the match folder. "Close cover before striking," he read. "Can you draw this horse? First art lesson free, no obligation. Turn over for free enrollment blank." Unblinking, he stared on and on while Lou Notting and Fred Clark argued about abstract ideas such as the curtailment of liberties, the democratic process. He heard all the words perfectly clearly, and he did not mind listening, but he felt no desire to argue, even though he knew they both were wrong. He let them argue on. It was easier. It simply happened, and he let it happen. "Jack's not with us tonight," Clark was saying. With a start, Jack Bolin realized they had turned their attention on him. He had to do or say something now. "Sure I am," he said, and it cost him terrific effort. It was like rising up out of the sea. "Go on, I'm listening." "God, you're like a dummy," Notting said. "Go home and go to bed, for Christ's sakes." Entering the living room, Lou's wife Phyllis said, "You'll never get to Mars in the state you're in now, Jack." She turned up the hi-fi. It was a progressive jazz group, vibes and double bass, or perhaps it was an electronic instrument playing. Blonde, pert Phyllis seated herself on the couch near him and studied him. "Jack, are you sore at us? I mean, you're so withdrawn." "It's just one of his moods," Notting said. "When we were in the service, he used to get them, especially on Saturday night. Morose and silent, brooding. What are you brooding about right now, Jack?" The question seemed odd to him. He was not brooding about anything. His mind was empty. The match folder still filled up his range of perception. Nevertheless, it was necessary that he give them an account of what he was brooding over. They all expected it, so dutifully he made up a topic. "The air," he said. "On Mars. How long will it take me to adjust?" "Varies among different people." A yawn, which never came out, had lodged in his chest, diffusing throughout his lungs and windpipe. It left his mouth hanging partly open. With an effort, he managed to close his jaws.
"Guess I better go on," he said. "Hit the sack."
With the use of all his strength, he managed to get to his feet.
"At 9 o'clock?" Fred Clark yelled.
Later, as he walked home to his apartment along the cool, dark streets of Oakland, he felt fine. He wondered what had been wrong back there at Notting's. Maybe bad air or the ventilation. But something was wrong. Mars, he thought. He had cut the ties, in particular his job, had sold his Plymouth, given notice to the official who was his landlord, and it had taken him a year to get the apartment. The building was owned by the nonprofit West Coast Co-op, an enormous structure partly underground with thousands of units, its own supermarket, laundries, child care center, clinic, even its own psychiatrist, down below in the arcade of shops beneath the street level. There was an FM radio station on the top floor which broadcast classical music chosen by the building residents, and in the center of the building could be found a theater and meeting hall. This was the newest of the huge cooperative apartment buildings, and he had given it all up suddenly. One day he had been in the building's bookstore waiting in line to buy a book, and the idea came to him. After he had given notice, he had wandered along the corridors of the co-op arcade. When he came to the bulletin board with its tacked-up notices, he had halted automatically to read them. Children scampered past him on their way to the playground behind the building. One notice, large and printed, attracted his attention. "Help spread the co-op movement to newly colonized areas. Emigration prepared by the co-op board in Sacramento in answer to big business and big labor union exploitation of mineral-rich areas of Mars. Sign up now." It read much like all the co-op notices, and yet, why not? A lot of young people were going, and what was left for him on Earth? He had given up his co-op apartment, but he was still a member. He still had his share of stock and his number. Later on, when he had signed up and was in the process of being given his physical and his shots, the sequence had blurred in his mind. He remembered the decision to go to Mars as coming first, and then the giving up of his job and apartment. It seemed more rational that way, and he told that story to his friends. But it simply wasn't true. What was true? For almost 2 months he had wandered about, confused and despairing, not certain of anything except that on November 14th his group, 200 co-op members, would leave for Mars, and then everything would be changed. The confusion would lift, and he would see clearly, as he had once at some vague period in the past. He knew that. Once he had been able to establish the order of things in space and time. Now, for reasons unknown to him, both space and time had shifted so that he could not find his bearings in either one. His life had no purpose. For 14 months he had lived with one massive goal, to acquire an apartment in the huge new co-op building. And then, when he had gotten it, there was nothing. The future had ceased to exist. He listened to the box sweets which he requested. He bought food at the supermarket and browsed in the building bookstore. But what for? He asked himself. Who am I? And at his job, his ability faded away. That was the first indication, and in some ways the most ominous of all. That was what had first frightened him. It began with a weird incident which he was never able to fully account for. Apparently, part of it had been pure hallucination. But which part? It had been dreamlike, and he had had a moment of overwhelming panic, the desire to run, to get out at any cost. His job was with an electronics firm in Redwood City, south of San Francisco. He operated a machine which maintained quality control along the assembly line. It was his responsibility to see that his machine did not deviate from its concept of acceptable tolerances in a single component. A liquid helium battery no larger than a match head. One day he was summoned to the personnel manager's office, unexpectedly. He did not know why they wanted him, and as he took the elevator up, he was quite nervous. Later he remembered that. He was unusually nervous. "Come in, Mr. Bolin." The personnel manager, a fine-looking man with curly gray hair, perhaps a fashion wig, welcomed him into his office. "This won't take but a moment." He eyed Jack keenly. "Mr. Bolin, why aren't you cashing your paychecks?" There was silence. "Aren't I?" Jack said. His heart thudded ponderously, making his body shake. He felt unsteady and tired. "I thought I was," he said to himself.
You could stand a new suit, the personnel manager said. And you need a haircut. Of course, it's your business.
Putting his hand to his scalp, Jack felt about, puzzled. Did he need a haircut? Hadn't he just had one last week? Or maybe it was longer ago than that.
He said, thanks.
He nodded.
Okay, I will, what you just said.
And then the hallucination, if it was that, happened. He saw the personnel manager in a new light. The man was dead. He saw, through the man's skin, his skeleton. It had been wired together, the bones connected with fine copper wire. The organs, which had withered away, were replaced by artificial components, kidney, heart, lungs. Everything was made of plastic and stainless steel, all working in unison but entirely without authentic life. The man's voice issued from a tape through an amplifier and speaker system. Possibly at some time in the past the man had been real and alive, but that was over. The stealthy replacement had taken place, inch by inch, progressing insidiously from one organ to the next, and the entire structure was there to deceive others. To deceive him, Jack Bolin, in fact. He was alone in this office. There was no personnel manager. No one spoke to him, and when he himself talked, no one heard. It was entirely a lifeless, mechanical room in which he stood. He was not sure what to do. He tried not to stare too hard at the man-like structure before him. He tried to talk calmly, naturally, about his job and even his personal problems. The structure was probing. It wanted to learn something from him. Naturally, he told it as little as possible. And all the time, as he gazed down at the carpet, he saw its pipes and valves and working parts functioning away. He could not keep from seeing. All he wanted to do was get away as soon as possible. He began to sweat. He was dripping with sweat and trembling, and his heart pounded louder and louder. Bolin, the structure said. Are you sick?
Yes, he said. Can I go back down to my bench now?
He turned and started toward the door.
Just a moment, the structure said from behind him.
That was when panic overtook him, and he ran. He pulled the door open and ran out into the hall. An hour or so later, he found himself wandering along an unfamiliar street in Burlingame. He did not remember the intervening time, and he did not know how he had gotten where he was. His legs ached. Evidently, he had walked, mile after mile. His head was much clearer. I'm schizophrenic, he said to himself. I know it. Everyone knows the symptoms. It's catatonic excitement with paranoid coloring. The mental health people drill it into us, even into the school kids. I'm another one of those. That was what the personnel manager was probing. I need medical help. As Jack removed the power supply of the angry janitor and laid it on the floor, the master circuit of the school said, "You are very skillful." Jack glanced up at the middle-aged female figure and thought to himself, "It's obvious why this place unnerves me. It's like my psychotic experience of years ago. Did I, at that time, look into the future?" There had been no schools of this kind then, or if there had, he had not seen them or known about them. "Thank you," he said. What had tormented him ever since the psychotic episode with the personnel manager at Corona Corporation was this. Suppose it was not a hallucination. Suppose the so-called personnel manager was as he had seen him, an artificial construct, a machine like these teaching machines. If that had been the case, then there was no psychosis. Instead of a psychosis, he had thought again and again, it was more on the order of a vision, a glimpse of absolute reality with the facade stripped away. And it was so crushing, so radical an idea that it could not be meshed with his ordinary views, and the mental disturbance had come out of that. Reaching into the exposed wiring of the angry janitor, Jack felt expertly with his long fingers until at last he touched what he knew to be there. A broken lead. "I think I've got hold of it," he said to the master circuit of the school. Thank God, he thought, these aren't the old-fashioned printed circuits. Were that the case, he would have to replace the unit. Repair would be impossible.
"My understanding," the master circuit said, "is that much effort went into the designing of the teachers' re-problems of repair. We have been fortunate so far. No prolonged interruption of service has taken place. However, I believe that preventive maintenance is indicated wherever possible. Therefore, I would like you to inspect one additional teacher, which has as yet shown no signs of a breakdown. It is uniquely vital to the total functioning of the school."
The master circuit paused politely as Jack struggled to get the long tip of the soldering iron past the layers of wire.
"It is Kindly Dad which I want you to inspect."
Jack said, "Kindly Dad." And he thought acidly, "I wonder if there's an Aunt Mom in here somewhere. Aunt Mom's delicious home-baked tall tales for little tots to imbibe." He felt nauseated.
"You are familiar with that teacher?"
As a matter of fact, he was not. David hadn't mentioned it. From farther down the corridor, he could hear the children still discussing life with the Whitlock. Their voices reached him as he lay on his back, holding the soldering gun above his head and reaching into the works of the angry janitor to keep the tip in place.
"Yes," the Whitlock was saying in its never-ruffled, absolutely placid voice. "The raccoon is an amazing fellow, old Jimmy Raccoon is. Many times I've seen him, and he's quite a large fellow, by the way, with powerful long arms, which are really quite agile."
"I saw a raccoon once," a child piped excitedly. "Mr. Whitlock, I saw one, and he was this close to me."
Jack thought, "You saw a raccoon on Mars?" The Whitlock chuckled.
"No, Don, I'm afraid not. There aren't any raccoons around here. You'd have to go all the way across over to old Mother Earth to see one of those amazing fellas. But the point I'd like to make is this, boys and girls. You know how old Jimmy Raccoon takes his food and carries it oh so stealthily to the water and washes it? And how we laughed at old Jimmy when the lump of sugar dissolved and he had nothing at all left to eat? Well, boys and girls, do you know that we've got Jimmy Raccoons right here in this very—"
"I think I'm finished," Jack said, withdrawing the gun. "Do you want to help me put this back together?" The master circuit said,
"Are you in a rush?"
"I don't like that thing talking away in there," Jack said. It made him tense and shaky, so much so that he could hardly do his work. A door rolled shut down the corridor from them. The sound of the Whitlock's voice ceased.
"Is that better?" the master circuit asked.
"Thanks," Jack said. But his hands were still shaking. The master circuit noted that. He was aware of her precise scrutiny. He wondered what she made of it. The chamber in which Kindly Dad sat consisted of one end of a living room with fireplace, couch, coffee table, curtained picture window, and an easy chair in which Kindly Dad himself sat, a newspaper open on his lap. Several children sat attentively on the couch as Jack Bolin and the master circuit entered. They were listening to the expostulations of the teaching machine and did not seem aware that anyone had come in. The master circuit dismissed the children, and then she started to leave too.
"I'm not sure what you want me to do," Jack said. "Put it through its cycle. It seems to me that it repeats portions of the cycle or stays stuck. In any case, too much time is consumed. It should return to its starting stage in about 3 hours."
A door opened for the master circuit, and she was gone. He was alone with Kindly Dad, and he was not glad of it. "Hi, Kindly Dad," he said without enthusiasm. Setting down his tool case, he began unscrewing the back plate of the teacher. Kindly Dad said in a warm, sympathetic voice, "What's your name, young fellow?" "My name," Jack said as he unfastened the plate and laid it down beside him, "is Jack Bolin, and I'm a Kindly Dad too, just like you, Kindly Dad. My boy is 10 years old, Kindly Dad, so don't call me a young fellow, okay?" Again he was trembling hard and sweating.
"Oh," Kindly Dad said, "I see."
"What do you see?" Jack said, and discovered that he was almost shouting. "Look," he said, "go through your goddamn cycle, okay? If it makes it easier for you, go ahead and pretend I'm a little boy." "I just want to get this done and get out of here," he said to himself, with as little trouble as possible. He could feel the swelling, complicated emotions inside him. 3 hours, he thought dismally. Kindly Dad said,
"Little Jackie, it seems to me you've got a mighty heavy weight on your chest today, am I right?"
"Today and every day." Jack clicked on his trouble light and shone it up into the works of the teacher. The mechanism seemed to be moving along its cycle properly so far.
"Maybe I can help you," Kindly Dad said. "Often it helps if an older, more experienced person can sort of listen in on your troubles, can sort of share them and make them lighter."
"Okay," Jack agreed, sitting back on his haunches. "I'll play along. I'm stuck here for 3 hours anyhow." "You want me to go all the way back to the beginning, to the episode back on Earth when I worked for Corona Corporation and had the occlusion?"
"Start wherever you like," Kindly Dad said graciously.
"Do you know what schizophrenia is, Kindly Dad?"
I believe I've got a pretty good idea, Jackie, Kindly Dad said.
Well, Kindly Dad, it's the most mysterious malady in all medicine, that's what it is, and it shows up in 1 out of every 6 people, which is a lot of people.
Yes, that certainly is, Kindly Dad said.
At one time, Jack said as he watched the machinery moving, I had what they call situational polymorphous schizophrenia simplex. And Kindly Dad, it was rough.
I just bet it was, Kindly Dad said.
Now, I know what you're supposed to be for, Jack said. I know your purpose, Kindly Dad. We're a long way from home, millions of miles away. Our connection with our civilization back home is tenuous, and a lot of folks are mighty scared, Kindly Dad, because with each passing year, that link gets weaker. So this public school was set up to present a fixed milieu to the children born here, an Earth-like environment. For instance, this fireplace. We don't have fireplaces here on Mars. We heat by small atomic furnaces. That picture window with all that glass. Sandstorms would make it opaque. In fact, there's not one thing about you that's derived from our actual world here. Do you know what a Bleakman is, Kindly Dad?
Can't say that I do, little Jackie. What is a Bleakman?
It's one of the indigenous races of Mars. You know you're on Mars, don't you? Kindly Dad nodded. Schizophrenia, Jack said, is one of the most pressing problems human civilization has ever faced. Frankly, Kindly Dad, I emigrated to Mars because of my schizophrenic episode when I was 22 and worked for Corona Corporation. I was cracking up. I had to move out of a complex urban environment into a simpler one, a primitive frontier environment with more freedom. The pressure was too great for me. It was emigrate or go mad. That co-op building, can you imagine a thing going down level after level and up like a skyscraper, with enough people living there for them to have their own supermarket? I went mad standing in line at the bookstore. Everybody else, Kindly Dad, every single person in that bookstore and in that supermarket, all of them lived in the same building I did. It was a society, Kindly Dad, that one building, and today it's small by comparison with some that have been built. What do you say to that?
My, my, Kindly Dad said, shaking his head.
Now here's what I think, Jack said. I think this public school and you teaching machines are going to rear another generation of schizophrenics, the descendants of people like me who are making a fine adaptation to this new planet. You're going to split the psyches of these children because you're teaching them to expect an environment which doesn't exist for them. It doesn't even exist back on Earth now. It's obsolete. Ask that Whitlock teacher if intelligence doesn't have to be practical to be true intelligence. I heard it say so. It has to be a tool for adaptation. Right, Kindly Dad?
Yes, little Jackie, it has to be.
What you ought to be teaching, Jack said, is how do we...
Yes, little Jackie, Kindly Dad interrupted him. It has to be.
And as it said this, a gear tooth slipped in the glare of Jack's trouble light, and a phase of the cycle repeated itself. You're stuck, Jack said. Kindly Dad, you've got a worn gear tooth.
Yes, little Jackie, Kindly Dad said. It has to be.
You're right, Jack said. It does have to be. Everything wears out eventually. Nothing is permanent. Change is the one constant of life, right, Kindly Dad?
Yes, little Jackie, Kindly Dad said. It has to be.
Shutting off the teaching machine at its power supply, Jack began to disassemble its main shaft, preparatory to removing the worn gear.
So you found it, the master circuit said, when Jack emerged a half hour later, wiping his face with his sleeve. Yes, he said. He was exhausted. His wristwatch told him that it was only 4 o'clock. An hour more of work lay ahead of him. The master circuit accompanied him to the parking lot. I'm quite pleased with the promptness with which you attended to our needs, she said. I will telephone Mr. Yi and thank him. He nodded and climbed into his copter, too worn out even to say goodbye. Soon he was ascending. The duck egg, which was the UN-operated public school, became small and far away below him. Its stifling presence vanished, and he could breathe again. Flipping on his transmitter, he said, Mr. Yi, this is Jack. I'm done at the school. What next? After a pause, Mr. Yi's pragmatic voice answered, Jack, Mr. Arne Cott at Lewistown called us. He requested that we service an encoding dictation machine in which he places great trust. Since all others of our crew are tied up, I am sending you.